mashed potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio, and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films Barbie, Oppenheimer, Cobweb, The Deepest Breath, and Special Ops Lioness. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the trailer park, and the home cinema roundup featuring The Burning. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
There's a bunch of news I want to get to, so let's jump right in and talk about the box office for Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1, which came in a little bit low with about $55 million for the three-day. That means different because it opened on Wednesday, so it was a total of $78.5 million for the five-day, which is actually, I mean, it's on the high end of the Mission Impossible movies, but these are not Top Gun numbers. And like I said last week, don't expect Top Gun numbers because Mission Impossible is going to play like a different movie. Now, this will likely have legs through the rest of the summer, so it's going to end up legging it out to some pretty decent numbers, both domestic and international, but you're not going to have this juggernaut that has the massive opening weekend. The next piece of news I want to talk about is AMC has finally dropped its idea of charging more for premium seats, which is good because it was a stupid idea. This is not Broadway. This is so stupid of AMC. I mean, AMC, dumb business decision, because at a point where you're trying to bring more people into a theater, your idea was to charge people more, and that was the selling point? Nobody was buying those tickets. So they dropped that, and they're going to try something different, where they're like going to go, we're going to do a premium front row seat. Oh, just realize that movie theaters play different than Broadway theaters. And the bringing the people in is comfort and some sort of control of the audience. And when you don't have that, that's what drives people away. I mean, I went and saw Oppenheimer at a preview show and people still were pulling out their phones and looking at their phones. I'm not talking about looking at it to see what time it is because they're trying to clock in a 3-hour movie. People checking texts and replying to things and surfing Twitter and all that kind of nonsense in the middle of a premium movie that everybody was there ostensibly to see because it was like 5 o'clock on a Thursday. Another piece of news, which I found kind of interesting, was Netflix had their quarter earnings, and it turns out they're not just in the black, they're way more in the black than they expected. And part of the reason for this is because productions have shut down. They're not spending money on actors and writers developing things and shooting things because you have two strikes going on at the same time. So while that's a positive news for Netflix, hey, they have more money than they thought they would. They don't have anything to spend it on. So that's kind of one of those interesting stories that on the surface, it looks great for a network, but it may not be a good thing necessarily. Another piece of news that hit this weekend is Disney Plus is putting Ms. Marvel onto ABC. It's going to be on the Wonderful World of Disney in the next couple weeks. And I think it's going to do it as a two-parter. They're putting the episodes from the Disney Plus series. And a lot of people have been like, oh, look, Al, they're pivoting towards broadcast. It's like, I don't know if they're necessarily pivoting towards broadcast. Because the news just came out that they're going to be putting Secret Invasion onto Hulu outside of Disney Plus. They're sort of pushing it to a different platform. And that doesn't necessarily say anything more than they're trying to build content with content they already have. You can't shoot anything new. You can't produce anything new. You've got a writer strike and an actor strike that is likely not going to be wrapped up, possibly for a good chunk of this year. So they got to figure out a way to do it. Plus, Ms. Marvel and Secret Invasion both lead into The Marvels, which is the next big Marvel movie, which comes out in November. So this is just sort of trying to cross-pollinate and seed the audience. So you get a bigger audience who knows the background of some of these people. Don't get me wrong. At some point, you're going to see Captain Marvel showing up there, too, because they need to add these characters. And heck, you might see WandaVision show up on The Wonderful World of Disney because it plays into the background you'll need for the Marvels. And they're trying to make sure enough people see that so they will want to see the movie when it comes to the theaters. The last piece of news is just something I find interesting, and I want to talk about that here rather than in the reviews, is the whole Barbenheimer phenomenon. I think it's hilarious that these two movies have kind of organically melded together as a marketing ploy, and I don't think that anybody at Warner Brothers or Universal planned this. It just sort of developed because they're so weirdly, strangely different movies. But this is not the first time that's happened. I mean, if you go back to 2008, The Dark Knight came out the same weekend of Mamma Mia. It was just called counter-programming back then. Also in 2008, when Iron Man came out, they had this rom-com with Patrick Dempsey called Maid of Honor, I think. Both came out the same weekend. That was not uncommon when you have a big superhero movie come out that they would release like a romantic comedy or something. Something that was very male-centric and they'd buffer it with a female movie. So this is nothing new. I think that the memeing of Barbenheimer, I think, is kind of funny. But I don't know if it's necessarily, I mean, it's raising awareness, sure. I don't know if it's going to make more people see the movies. I mean, everyone's going to make their own narrative based on the box office this weekend. But really, I mean, like Barbie, you never know what it's going to do in the box office, because if it plays like an organic movie that women discover and like, it will have longer legs. But if it plays like a movie that has an immediate demand, you're going to see high numbers at the beginning and it will be very, very front loaded. Like if you look at those Twilight movies, those things are so front loaded, whatever it made in its first 24 hours, double that, that was its weekend. Listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first movie I want to talk about is coming to theaters on September 15th, and that is A Haunting in Venice.
Hercule Poirot, I've found something. I am the smartest person I ever met, and I can't figure it out, so I came to the second. Come with me to a seance. Spot the con I can't.
Detective. You are here to discredit me, but I can talk to the dead.
Somebody is dead. No one shall leave this place until I know who did it.
A ghost killed her.
There must be a rational answer for all of this.
This is a Hercule Poirot movie, which I think is great that they're continuing to make these movies, because I Murder on the Orient Express did well enough, but I don't think Death of the Nile was a massive juggernaut in terms of box office. I like the fact that Kenneth Branagh is just saying, I'm going to keep making these movies because I like playing Hercule Poirot. And this is an Agatha Christie story. It plays into Halloween. So that's, I think, why they're releasing it in mid-September. This looks like it's going to be a fun movie. It doesn't look like it's going to be as big in terms of a production as Death on the Nile, but that's probably a good thing because I think Death on the Nile caused its own problem by trying to be too big, and some of the effects look kind of goofy. But I'm all for basically a horror movie version of Agatha Christie. The next one I want to talk about is Migration, which is an animated film coming to theaters on December 22nd.
They must be migrating.
Migration? What a stupid idea.
Okay, you're impossible.
Because I found a safe place for us to live.
I want us to get out and see the world.
What sort of father would I be if I put my young child in harm's way for no reason except a chance at a Caribbean vacation?
I don't want to miss out on life because you're afraid to leave this pond.
Here we go. Tail for the torsion.
Check.
Wing deployment.
Check.
Let's fly.
This is done by people from Illumination, and they do the Minions movies and The Secret Life of Pets. So, you know, it's about a bunch of ducks that decide to migrate and they end up in the big city. So it's a fish out of water type story, and it looks cute. I don't quite get a sense on whether this is going to actually have a story or a plot or a good through line to it, or if it's just going to be a sequence of jokes. You never know with an Illumination movie. You get a little better sense that there's going to be a real cogent story behind a Pixar movie. Illumination kind of blows hot and cold in that, but still, it looks cute, and I guess I'm going to look forward to it. I'll check it out when it comes out at Christmas. Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about the films Oppenheimer and Cobweb. welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the movie reviews and talk about the big one, or one of the big ones for the weekend, and that is Oppenheimer. Christopher Nolan directs this biopic of J. Robert Oppenheimer, spotlighting his work on the Manhattan Project.
We're in a race against the Nazis. And I know what it means. If the Nazis have a bomb, build a town, build it fast. If we don't let scientists bring their families, we'll never get the best.
Why would we go to the middle of nowhere for who knows how long?
How about because this is the most important thing to ever happen in the history of the world?
This is a Christopher Nolan movie. That's the best way I can describe it. And if you like Christopher Nolan, you get all the good stuff that you want from Christopher Nolan. You get the bombastic soundtrack. You get a heavy-weighted movie. You get the intense scenes and the long, drawn-out moments of contemplation. You get the feel that you're seeing cinema rather than just a movie. And although I didn't see it in IMAX, I don't know why it's worth seeing in IMAX. It's just a lot of people in rooms, but I mean, I can go home and look at rooms in high def with my eyes, but I guess if you like that 70 millimeter experience, then yeah, he delivers that. With that said, it has all the trappings of a Christopher Nolan movie. I mean, it's overly self-important. The writing is all over the place. I mean, it is so convoluted. It bounces back and forth, time here and there. And you feel like you have to have read Robert Oppenheimer's biography before seeing this movie for it to really, really make sense. And I mean, his writing isn't great. He writes this by himself. He usually has his brother writing with him, but he wrote this one by himself, and it shows. I mean, it's like when he wrote Dunkirk, and there's just no characters in that movie. It's just action sequences. There is no plot to Dunkirk, and it's half a movie. And I feel Oppenheimer falls into a lot of those tropes, but like he overcorrects. But even then, his like writing of women is awful. Emily Blunt's character is confusing and inconsistent. And you got Florence Pugh's character, which, and as much as I appreciate that half of her scenes are done topless, it seems a little bit objectifying to her. And it's almost like she was like, well, I'll only do a nude scene if it's Christopher Nolan. And he's like, good, you're going to be nude through every... Look, I appreciated seeing Florence Pugh naked, but it seemed weirdly lecherous from Nolan as a director. And also, Nolan's not as smart as people give him credit for, and certainly not as smart as he thinks he is. Because like he did in Interstellar, and like he did in Tenet, he just kind of brushes through the science. And this is a movie about science. It's literally a movie about a scientist is the main character. And they don't actually talk science. And I'm not saying you have to have a lecture in science, but I understand science, and they really blow through some of it, and they just kind of throw it in the background and don't, I think stuff that is like tenets of science, they don't do properly. So there's some real problems in this movie. It's also the pacing is awful. It's dull and it's boring and it doesn't seem to connect together. And by the time I was in the third act, I was like, why am I still watching this movie? They blew up the bomb hours ago, you know? So it's just, there's a lot of problems with, I'm getting very annoyed with Christopher Nolan as a director. I have not liked his movies particularly for probably the last 10 years. I mean, The Dark Knight Rises was probably his most recent movie I enjoyed. And even then, I had some serious problems with that one. That one got overly self-important and was not well written. And now everyone's like, oh, it's a masterpiece. Oh, God, it's the greatest thing. Look, like, Cillian Murphy does a great job. He's going to get an Oscar nomination. He may very well win the Oscar. And Robert Downey Jr. in the movie is fantastic in it, too. He's definitely going to get an Oscar nomination. Would not be surprised if he won, at least as the playing field is right now. But otherwise, the movie itself, it's overblown and it's bombastic. And you have these scenes that suddenly turn into, like, it's him flexing his art house muscles. He puts some sort of surreal elements in these scenes, but he doesn't do it with any sort of consistency. And there's also scenes, as you can expect from a Christopher Nolan movie, where you're listening to the dialogue and suddenly you can't hear the dialogue because the soundtrack is just so big and explosive because it's a movie about a bomb. I was frustrated and annoyed with Oppenheimer. The more I think about the movie, talk to me next week and I'll hate it. But I'm just like, it's okay. But it's not worth the hype. So, I mean, it's bloated and it's overblown, and Nolan shows little respect and understanding of actual science while he builds a convoluted narrative. This is very typical of a Christopher Nolan movie, and its stuff is just getting more and more so. And his stands out there are like, he's the greatest. I would watch anything he does. But really, I have to say this movie kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Cobweb. This is a smaller independent horror film out in theaters. A troubled child hears strange noises in the house and tries to discover the secrets hidden by his off-kilter parents.
No more nightmares tonight. Okay, champ? This is getting ridiculous.
This is an old house. There's bound to be bumps in the night.
Peter drew this?
Yes.
Is he all right?
Peter has an overactive imagination.
No more nightmares.
No more.
That's right.
This one stars Lizzie Caplan. I've had a thing for Lizzie Caplan for years. And I mean, she's not sexy in this movie. She plays this overbearing, brittle mother. But I like her. I like seeing her in movies. And the guy who plays her husband, I forget his name, but it took me a while because he's got brown hair in this movie. He's not blonde, but I realized, oh, that's Homelander from The Boys. So already you've got creepy Lizzie Caplan and Homelander as the parents, and you're like, there's nothing good about these people. And it's the story of this kid trying to figure out what creepy, weird stuff's going on in his house. And there's a side plot with this teacher, the substitute teacher who takes interest in him. Now, this movie is made, like most movies are, with no understanding of actually how a school system would handle a child like this. But it makes for a good horror movie. And I gotta say, it works. But it's kind of standard. I mean, it's the bump in the night kind of thing, and there's something creepy in the walls, and he's hearing voices. And so it seems somewhat generic until it gets to the end. That last act, it has a great delivery, and it suddenly really charges into an intense horror film. And as much as I was critical of the pacing in the first two acts, it works as a buildup to the third act, which goes completely bonkers, and it delivers. That's the thing. Part of suspense is not just drawing it out, but you have to have a delivery. The psycho shower scene, if you cut before the mother started stabbing Janet Leigh in the shower, it wouldn't be a good delivery. Part of what makes that suspense work is the payoff, and the payoff in this movie is great. The last 30 minutes of the movie are what makes it. And if you're going to have your strongest 30 minutes in your movie, make it the ending, because that's what people are going to remember. And that works. I mean, a paint-by-numbers creepiness opens the film. But it's that shocking third act that sells it. And that's what you need in a movie like this. And I was very happy with it, where I was sort of, my kids use the term mid. I felt that the beginning part was kind of mid, but by the time I got to the end, I'm like, yeah, no, this is a good movie. So, yeah, I'm going to have to say Cobweb rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about Barbie and Special Ops Lioness.
I'm a Barbie girl in the Barbie world. Life in plastic, it's fantastic.
Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews and talk about the other half of Barbenheimer. Barbie, and in this film, the iconic doll becomes self-aware and travels from Barbie world to the real world to help the girl playing with her.
Cold shower. Ooh. Falling off my roof. Ah! And my heels are on the ground.
What do I have to do?
You have to go to the real world. Barbie in the real world. That's impossible.
If this got out, this could mean extremely weird things for our world.
This would be catastrophic!
We haven't played with Barbie since we were like 5 years old.
Oh.
No one rests until this doll is back in a box.
This is directed by Greta Gerwig, and she did movies like Little Women and Lady Bird. She's a very good director and a very good writer in her own right. That doesn't sound correct. But she was an odd choice for this. I was kind of surprised when I heard she was going to make this movie. But her quirkiness feeds into it, and it works. Now, on the surface, it's a Barbie movie. It's a hot pink-colored, high-energy, silly film with a lot of fun. And especially when you're there in Barbie world, it's just a bunch of silliness and fun. And that's cool, and I like that. Now, once they get to the real world, there is a level of trying to break out of the constructs of the original Barbie. I mean, ever since Barbie was created in like the late 50s, Barbie has struggled against itself. Because when it first came out, it was the iconic doll and it was the 50s and nobody was really pushing feminist movement necessarily, not in the grand zeitgeist. But very soon, as you get into the 60s and certainly into the 70s and beyond, people were like, well, wait, this doll it's an unrealistic standard of beauty that is causing girls to do self-harm and eating disorders, and it's about rampant consumerism and buy, and there's a lot of plastic, and it also it emphasizes beauty over substance. And so over the decades, Mattel has fought desperately to try and change that and to give a feminist spin and give agency to women and girls as they play with the Barbies. And there's always the astronaut Barbie and the physicist Barbie and the Nobel Prize winner Barbie. And those Barbies exist in this movie. It's just not what this Barbie is about. And there's even parts where they're like, aha, and yeah, no, this is the stereotypical Barbie. She's not the astronaut. So it kind of gets in its own way because it's trying to have its feminist cake and eat it too. It's trying to be this empowering movie for girls, but it is just still about a beauty queen. So I don't, that has been the cross that Barbie has had to bear ever since. And in that sense, the movie leans at times too much into it. And I think part of it is Gerwig and her writing partner and partner in real life, Noah Baumbach, trying to kind of make it a little bit self-aware, and they push the awareness of the agency to girls a lot in this, and they do push gender politics there, but I think it's an appropriate discussion in this film because of the nature of the toy. But in doing so, it gets a little preachy, and you hear that a lot. And I know there's also been people saying, well, it's not a kids movie because it's about politics. Barbie's always been about politics ever since the 60s. But also, they're saying, well, it has dirty jokes. Well, I think it's a PG-13 movie. And we all know the anatomical makeup of Barbie and Ken. We all know that. We've all seen a naked Barbie doll in our lives at some point. So they make jokes about that. And they use clinical terms. So if you don't want to hear a medical term for what Barbie and Ken don't have, then you don't want to see this movie. But really, it's not that bad. I mean, it's not adult humor. It's like childish humor for that kind of stuff. So, like I said, the messaging gets in the way because I think part of it is Mattel in there. They got their fingerprints all over it, and they're really trying to manipulate the story and the image. So it's positive, but also plays towards their doll. And like I said, those things are in conflict anyways, and it kind of gets very murky. The other issue is when they go into the real world is just as silly as the Barbie world. And there's that level of surrealism in the real world that doesn't quite work. It's like the whole point is they're in the real world. This should be shocking. And to some people it's shocking, but other people are like, oh no, haha, this happened before. So, I mean, there are some things that don't quite make internal sense, but I mean, Margot Robbie's great in it. And Ryan Gosling is pretty funny as Ken. It overstates its welcome at times. There's a whole section in the middle where they're sort of the Barbies are trying to make a plan, and it gets very preachy at that point. At the end of the movie, it just keeps going on. It's like Return of the King. You're like, just get in the boat, Bilbo. I mean, you know, it could have been shorter. There were issues I had with it. It's not a perfect movie, but overall it's fun. It's silly and it's clever. So I'm going to say that Barbie, you know, I mean, it's clever and funny, but frustratingly shackled by Mattel's oversight. It's a cute diversion, but wants to be so much more. And it never quite achieves that because of, like I said, Mattel trying to control the narrative. So I'm still going to say it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. The next movie I want to talk about is actually a TV series. It's on Paramount Plus, and it airs on Sunday. So you're going to have to wait to check it out. I just want to give a little preview. Got a screener for it, and this is the best time to talk about it. And that series is Special Ops Lioness. A CIA operative recruits a new Marine with a troubled past to work undercover to target a major insurgent.
I'm doing everything different this time.
Should your field agent do what you think's best?
I have to be sure.
If she's able to make contact with the target, what are her directives then?
Neutralize the target.
Mr. President, we have a situation unfolding in real time.
Are you close?
Closer than we've ever been.
You up for playing outside the lines?
Ready to do my job, ma'am.
If your cover is blown, there is no saving you. You have to save yourself.
This is created by Taylor Sheridan. And stuff. So I've seen some of his films. Like, I thought Wind River was okay. And he wrote From Hell or High Water. And so I've seen several of his movies. Nobody really pays attention to his movies. He's best known now for making the series Yellowstone and 1883 and 1923 and all the other associated shows. Those movies romanticize the American West, and they're essentially soap operas, but they take place on a cattle ranch so guys can watch it. But this series is about the military, and so it fits in that machismo side of it, even though it's women. And I mean, Zoe Saldana plays the operative, Nicole Kidman's her boss. I mean, yeah, you got Morgan Freeman playing the president again. But you've got, it's a movie about women, but just because it's a movie about women doesn't mean it's not loaded with hyper masculinity. I mean, it still feels like a very hoorah kind of movie. And it's well put together. The thing with Taylor Sheridan is his stuff. He understands how stories work. He understands the arc. And like I said, whether his movies or TV series are essentially soap operas or westerns or a combination of both, he understands the rise and fall of dramatic tension. And that's kind of how this stuff works. But this is a little more in line with his TV stuff, like his series like Tulsa King or The Mayor of Kingstown. These sort of somebody up against extreme odds. So it is very serious and it's a bit heavy and dour, but it's at least a little bit of a diversion simply because it takes it from a female perspective. Even though the females are just guys with boobs in these movies, because he writes the females like he writes his male characters. He doesn't understand what really makes a woman, I guess. They're inauthentic female characters, but they have that badass nature. And that's, I guess, what makes it work. So, I mean, there's decent action and a tense drama, which highlights the series, though it still drips with Taylor Sheridan's hypermasculinity, despite its main female cast. But if you want to check it out, it's on Sundays on Paramount Plus, and I'm going to say it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr, I'm going to be talking about The Deepest Breath and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring The Burning. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews and talk about The Deepest Breath. This documentary from A24 and Netflix follows freedivers in their ongoing struggle to break world records.
Freediving is one of the world's deadliest extreme sports.
It's very simple. The deepest dive wins.
You've got to swim the length of a 70-story skyscraper.
Freediving is an extreme sport. And extreme sports have extreme consequences.
Alessia was after the world record, so she was going to push her limits.
She wanted to be better than the best freediver.
Freediving, literally what it sounds like, it's where people dive as deep as they possibly can on one breath. And right now, at least as the movie was explaining, the record's around 100 meters. Now, if you've not gone vertically down in the ocean, you don't understand how much 100 meters is. I mean, you can look, you know, remember when you were a kid in the track, the length of the track where it was straight, about 100 meters. And you can look at that and be like, that's not that far. Well, you got to remember, every meter you go down, you've got cubic meters of water pressing down on you. So the pressure gets intense. And also, it takes a while to swim that 100 meters down and then back up. People do this over the course of several minutes. Now, I bet you I couldn't hold my breath for 30 seconds. If I go down on the Titanic, I'm drowning. It's just amazing what these free divers do. But it's also extremely dangerous because you're going meters and meters below the surface of the, and there's no air because you're meters below the surface of the ocean. And however far you go, you got to be able to hold your breath to come back up. You're pushing yourself to go as far down as you can, but you can't burn it all out to get down because you still have to get up. And that's the challenge of free diving. And it's very dangerous and people die doing it. And so this is a documentary about this woman who is specifically trying to go for these world records and the relationship she has with one of her safety divers who they kind of follow the two of them as their careers meet. And I didn't know what would come of it. So there is a certain level of suspense because it's not a well-known sport unless you're focusing on it. So you don't know if someone's going to live or die or what's going to happen to them because they frame it very well where you don't know what's going on. And a lot of ways, this reminds me of the movie Free Solo, which was another documentary about an extreme sport, which is free climbing. And if you, again, pretty much if it involves the word free in front of it, as a sport, it's probably extremely dangerous because like free divers, free climbers climb mountains with no safety. It's just their hands and feet holding them onto the mountain. They don't have grapplings and belay lines or anything like that. And again, a lot of free climbers end up dying because you make a mistake free climbing and you plummet down to your death. You make a mistake free diving and you drown. And people push it to the point where they almost drown. They like black out, you know, a meter or two below the surface because they're pushing it as far as they can go. So it's a really interesting look at the sport. And it like most documentaries, it takes a little too long to get to the point, but it frames it really, really well. It's a fascinating documentary, because I don't know anything about the sport and it's an eye-opening look at a fringe extreme sport. And the real world dangers that the participants face. And you know, as you're watching the movie, you know something bad's going to happen to somebody at some point. But because these are not well-known sports figures and these are not well-known names, there is a suspense there. It's like, I remember there was that movie Man on Wire, which was about the guy who walked on a tightrope between the World Trade Towers in the 70s. They ended up making a movie called The Walk. Robert Zemeckis made that movie with Joseph Gordon-Levitt where he had a Pepe Le Pew accent, a real ridiculous French accent. And they made a feature of that, but there was a documentary about it, but they interviewed Philippe Pettit, who was the guy who did it. So you see interviews with him and he's talking about it. And you're like, well, you know, he doesn't fall because he's being interviewed right now. Whereas the way they construct the deepest breath is, you don't know what happens to the participants, and because they're not well-known people and it's not a well-known incident, you don't know what ends up happening. So it works. It's on Netflix right now. Worth checking out. I'm going to say it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. Want to talk about The Burning. I'm going a bit back into the archives, and part of it is because The Burning's getting a 4K release this week. It's a classic slasher movie, but oftentimes gets lost and forgotten or conflated with Friday the 13th. but it's its own separate thing. A group of campers and counselors at a summer camp are targeted by a madman during a canoe trip.
This summer, if you're planning to go camping, don't. If you're looking forward to midnight swims, don't. And if you're thinking about being with someone where no one can see you, don't. Because this summer, a legend of terror isn't just a campfire story anymore.
They say he smashed his way through the bunk room door, just a mass of flames.
One of the most notable things in this movie is it has the debuts of like Jason Alexander as a football jock, of all things. Fisher Stevens, when he was like 16, did this movie. And Holly Hunter. She has a very small part in it. She's not one of the main girls in it. But the other name that is forever tied to this movie is Harvey Weinstein. It's actually his debut film. He was trying to break into film at the time, in the early 80s or late 70s. And so he decided to work on, and I think he wrote this script that was essentially a slasher film at a camp. Now, it was started developing before Friday the 13th came out, but Friday the 13th came out about a year before it and beat it to the punch. So a lot of people consider this a knockoff, even though it's not. But it does play into the slasher craze that went on in the early 80s. And it's really hard to watch these movies that have Harvey Weinstein's name all over, and especially if you know he's heavily involved because he's such a creep. And as you watch the movie, you're like, because it's a slasher movie from the 80s, so it involves young women, you know, of course adult women, but younger women taking showers or whatever. There's a decent amount of nudity in this. And you feel creepy watching it because it's Harvey Weinstein. And if you know what he ends up doing as a person, you're like, I can't enjoy this like I can that brilliant sex scene in Friday the 13th Part 5. If you know, you know. But there are some interesting things to this movie. What it does is, it's not great in terms of the story. And these slasher movies were never brilliantly written. I mean, the original Halloween had a simplicity to it that really worked. And I mean, John Carpenter is actually a good writer. But, you know, like when Sean Cunningham made Friday the 13th, you knew he was just going for the more salacious parts of it. So he had the nudity and he had the blood and he had the kills. So he wasn't worried as much about pragmatic realism in his script. In The Burning, it's a little bit more sensational. And I went to summer camp in the 80s, and this was not the way summer camp was. The disregard for safety and morals that counselors had in these camp movies from the 80s were not consistent with the way things were, at least with the camp I went to. But there is a certain organic attachment I feel to movies, camp movies from the 80s, just because I grew up as a camper in the 80s. But the Burning works for what it is. It's an overpacked cast and it's, they're not well-written characters. And even the bad guy, because the bad guy is this guy who had been literally burned accidentally by these campers 5 years ago. And he's still stalking the woods and he has these hedge trimmers, and that's his method of choice. I mean, Jason has the machete. Freddy has the knife hands. The Burning guy, he's got hedge trimmers. It's a notable early installment in the campground slasher genre. It's overwritten and shallow, but it still delivers on all the classic tropes. You have the blood, you have killings, you have the nudity that you would expect from an 80s slasher movie, and that's kind of what makes it work. Harvey Weinstein's involvement aside, it still kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for this week. I need to go. Next week I'm going to be talking about Haunted Mansion, Sympathy for the Devil, and Good Omens Season 2. And until then, have a fat time at the movies or at home.